Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and I'm joined today by an award-winning comics artist, animator, and oil painter. His graphic novels and monographs have included admiring introductions from the likes of comedian David Cross and filmmakers Guillermo del Toro and David Cronenberg. And he's been touring the Pacific Northwest behind his comics series, Doghead. Dave Cooper, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Thank you, Conch. I'm so happy to be here.
So, Dave, now this might be an oversight, but we haven't had many painters on the show. What drew you to oil painting? It's a famously tricky medium.
Yeah, since I was a kid, I've toyed with different media. I guess when in my teens, I started coloring my comic books with watercolor, and then I'd move on to gouache, and then I started getting the bug to become a painter and switch to acrylic. And in all those media, I was always trying to reach a certain objective and not being able to get there. And one day I just decided to try oil, which a lot of artists are discouraged to do because they're told that you need to know tons of technique and it's very complicated. And I'm a self-taught artist, so I just usually jump right into things and make lots of mistakes. But my first oil painting to me was a huge epiphany. Like, it just, to this day, when I look at it, I'm very proud of it, even though it's not a great painting. It's like, it kind of represents to me how sort of stubborn I can be and just how I'll jump onto things and figure them out.
So you're not really a super technique-based guy. Are you a fan of the old masters? Do you try some of the stuff that they did?
I love that work, and I try to achieve some of those deep, sort of like the depth that you see in that kind of work. And I mostly just have figured it out on my own, being self-taught. But yeah, that stuff just is so inspiring. So I'm always sort of shooting for that kind of volume and texture.
Yeah, and the way that your paintings play with light, you know, I figure you're probably doing that thing with lots of thin layers, underpainting and glazes. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a technique that kind of drives me crazy. I kind of wish that I was not as process-based, but anytime I've tried to make my method more efficient, it always comes up short. So I have to build up these paintings in thin layers and make a lot of mistakes. And it just is this really frustrating, seemingly endless process sometimes. But like, it seems like the difficulty that I have in painting is also the reason that it ends up having some depth and interest to it. Whenever I'm like technically proficient at something, I find things get a little boring. So that's another part of my career, is that I'm always trying new things so that I can put myself into a position where I don't feel comfortable and I have to sort of struggle. It would be nice to be able to just have like a smooth sailing kind of process. But with comics, with music, with painting, I just always feel more comfortable if I'm having to struggle somehow, you know, and I don't know what I'm doing. Like, it's the discovery and the exploration that's really interesting for me.
Well, you're in good company, being a painter who also makes comics. Folks like Alex Ross and Bill Sienkiewicz, you know, are really prominent. And there's also Frank Frazetta, who actually started out in newspaper comics.
Right. And one of my favorite artists who I just visited in Vancouver is Ryan Heschka, who's a fantastic painter and comic book artist. I guess the two, you know, play off of each other. Like, I often have like a hunger for one, and then I become satiated and bored, and I just switch over to the other, and then there's like that fresh hunger again. I think if I were only a painter or only a comic book artist, I would be just miserable. I kind of have like an ADHD thing going on, I guess.
Yeah, that's not uncommon. There are a couple of monographs of your paintings out there. These books include introductions by comedian David Cross and filmmaker Guillermo del Toro. Your work, and not just paintings, but also ink drawings and pencil sketches, they found homes with influential collectors, big names in Hollywood. That's pretty cool.
It's exciting. I love it. Like when Guillermo del Toro first contacted me to do a private commission, I could barely understand what was going on. You just feel so grateful. And one of my biggest Hollywood crushes, Patricia Arquette, has bought work for me, and I got to meet her at one of my openings, and it's kind of thrilling. I'm kind of a nerd in that way.
One of the hallmarks of your work is the bright, saturated color schemes. And then there's all these highlights and odd surfaces and textures. I was reading a review of one of your monographs. It's called Bent. And the writer says, "Everything in this world seems to be undulating and overripe. The multicolored jello vegetation, the billowing clouds, and the twitching, agitated women."
Oh my God, I love that.
It's true that, when I look at a lot of your comics, there are definitely a lot of ample women, and also they're populated by guys with big sausage heads and tiny limbs.
Yeah, there's a lot going on there. I guess I'm always trying to capture some kind of like almost like overexcited emotion, like everybody's on the verge of bursting out laughing or crying or attacking each other sexually. It's just like a feast of emotion that I'm after. And the undulating, like there's a quality in my paintings that I'm always, it's like something that I'm not looking for or trying to do, but until my painting achieves that, it doesn't feel finished. Like it just has to be sort of bubbling or shining or vibrating somehow. Like my painting technique is a sort of agitated scumbling effect, and layers and layers of that can make the painting feel like it's sort of moving a little bit.
Well, there are a lot of artistic movements like the Dadaists and the Surrealists in the early 20th century who are really into the psychological state underneath, bringing that to the surface. And I definitely see that kind of surreal imagery in your work. Is that one of your influences?
A little bit, yeah. I love the surrealist. It's just this emotional state that I'm trying to achieve. Yeah, I guess I can't think of how better to express that.
Visual metaphor is kind of a big thing. I guess you're a Hieronymus Bosch fan. Some
Yeah,
people
yeah.
consider Bosch a 16th century surrealist. There's a commission you painted for a museum in Madrid that was inspired by the Garden of Earthly Delights, that epic triptych by Bosch.
Yeah, that was an incredible experience as well. They commissioned this 13-foot wide tribute in three panels. So it was so big that in my studio at home, I was only able to work on one panel at a time. So I've never even seen the painting intact. But in January, I think we're going to be going to Madrid for the first time to visit Collection Solo, the museum that commissioned it. So I'm going to be doing a signing there, and I'll be able to see that painting the way it was meant to be seen for the first time. It was incredible being able to sort of play in that world. They commissioned a number of works by different artists for the 500th anniversary of Bosch's death, I think. And I wanted to establish in the beginning that I'm not like I don't want to copy Bosch in any way. I want to create my own completely unique version of that vibe. And they were 100% into that. So I created all these bizarre characters, and then the one of the central images on the first panel is God sort of floating above Adam and Eve. And I think I drew, how did I do that? I think I made myself God, and Adam was Bosch. And then there was like a standard sort of female figure representing Eve. And they were like, "We love all these insane characters, but this trio seems a little conventional." So I created these most revolting versions of God I could think of, just to sort of amuse myself. And I sent all three, and I was like, "Do any of these appeal to you?" Like one, I think, was just a tapeworm, like a slimy tapeworm. One was this character with two gigantic penises. One was basically his head, and at the end of each penis was an eyeball, and it had a big antlers. And they were like, "That's perfect. We love that one. This is more like what we're talking about." And I changed Adam to a wolf, and Eve is this weird bird character. So, ever since, I've been using those three characters a lot in my drawings and paintings because they just make me laugh. But over the course of like 5 or 6 years since I made that painting, I've been toying with those characters so much that eventually they ended up being the central figures in this one of the two stories in this comic that I just came out with, Doghead.
Yeah, I want to talk about Doghead, but I'm really glad you're going to get a chance to see your full painting on a wall in a gallery. And
I think it'll be incredible. And there's also a toy that was based on my Eve, the bird character. So the company that made that toy is in Madrid. So it should be a really fun evening.
yeah, I guess, well, maybe, 5 centuries from now, people will be trying to parse your images for metaphors.
I hope so. Yeah, when I've seen people interpret my work, I've always been so impressed at the clever things they find that I had no awareness of.
I know, as an artist, you make a piece and then you put it out there and you let the audience tell you what it means.
Yeah, I mean, I admire people who are so intellectual and can really pull their work apart, but that's definitely not me. I've never been that way. I think there's a lot in my work, but the way that I arrive at it is just complete intuitive play, you know.
Well, let me reintroduce you. You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, SW Conser, and we're talking today with Dave Cooper. He's a comics artist, animator, and oil painter. His books include Underbelly, Overbite, Ripple, and Pillowy, The Art of Dave Cooper. His latest comic project is a large format book called Doghead. So tell us a little bit about Doghead. It's the sort of story or stories that I admit I have some difficulty describing.
So there are two stories that I'm serializing in Doghead that will ultimately be their own graphic novels. One is called Yardstakes Worth, and it centers around those characters I was describing from my Bosch painting. God, there's two mothers' natures, there's Adam and Eve, and my character Eddie, who I've been using for years and years. And it's just like a bizarre, cartoony, surreal world. Yardstick is God, and in the story he's overcome with this feeling of dread. Then he has to go into the mortal world and find out what the root of that is. So during the whole graphic novel, he's traveling through the world, and we get to meet all these bizarre characters. And the other story is L'Architect, which is centers around a young French architect who is invited to rural Nova Scotia in the 1970s to help a creepy young couple build an addition to their house. And it's sort of filled with all kinds of foggy memories from my childhood growing up in Nova Scotia. And it's pretty unsettling and creepy. It's almost like a thriller. It's unlike stories I've done in the past. And I feel like I'm kind of pushing myself and going into new territory a lot.
Right. You spent your early years in Nova Scotia, out in the eastern seaboard of Canada, the Maritimes, and that was well before Halifax became a center for animation and special effects. It was still mostly, I guess, a maritime fishing and farming
Yeah,
island there.
I was there just for the early part of my childhood. We moved away when I was 9, but we lived in a beautiful little fishing village called Shelburne. My dad was the town doctor. They had emigrated from England in the 50s. And that time in my life was hugely imprinting, I guess. A lot of the visuals in my work all come from experiences I had then, walking around in the woods. I enjoyed solitude as a kid, and I would go in the woods by myself and just obsess over beautiful little patches of moss and watch the animals. And yeah, it was a beautiful time, but there were also like disturbing things from that time. So all that stuff kind of gets mixed up and shaken and poured out into my work.
Some people would consider your comics to be definitely in the adult demographic. I think my introduction to your comics was a little title called Cynthia Petal's Really Fantastic Alien Sex Frenzy.
Gosh, you like at the time you were reading that stuff?
I think it was shortly after it came out. It became really popular
Wow,
in the
that's a long time
1990s.
ago. Yeah, that was a strange book. I actually saw that as a possibility to make money. But in retrospect, it's like, what the hell was I thinking? I think I was making underground comics, and Fantagraphics had an imprint called Eros Comics, where they would, make pornographic comics.
Yeah, Eros, Eros. And I think your first Fantagraphics book was Suckle. Then there was a periodical that you did called Weasel, which ended up winning both the Ignatz Award and the Harvey Award in 2000.
Yeah, I think that might actually be a misprint. I think it only won one of those two. But yeah, the Weasel was an incredible. I mean, I just felt so grateful to be making work with Fantagraphics because I was a huge fan of so much that they did, and to feel like I was a part of that for a while was really exciting. Ripple, one of the stories that I serialized in Weasel, is still one of the things I'm most proud of in comics.
Yeah, and that was sort of a psychoerotic graphic novel, Ripple. And that book has an introduction by David Cronenberg, who's all about the body horror. So I guess you and he are sort of mutual admiration.
Yeah, he's one of my biggest influences. I've always been a huge fan of his work. I think after I finished making Ripple in Weasel over 5 issues, I sent all those 5 issues. Somehow I was able to find his address. I think I had a friend who knew his son or something like that, and I sent him the whole package and asked him if he'd be interested in writing the introduction, and he got back to me in like a week or something. I was blown away. I couldn't believe it. We actually talked about him adapting the film for a little while.
Really?
Yeah, I was so excited. I was like, okay, I'll write, an adaptation for it, and I wrote it with a friend of mine, and we sent it to him, and he was like, something like, this doesn't really add anything to the book, or something like that. I was devastated. I couldn't believe I'd messed that up. I probably should have just said, yes, do whatever you want with it. Like, I'll step aside.
Well, tell us a little bit about the plot of Ripple, such as it is.
It's a very simple story, but it's like deeply passionate, I guess. It's an older artist who becomes obsessed with a young model who is traditionally unattractive, I guess, but he becomes just completely fixated, and they have this very unhealthy relationship. And it's an example of the way that I love to write, which is the seed of the story comes from something autobiographical, and then I distort every detail completely out of whack so that there's basically nothing left of reality, but it's imbued with this deep passion and meaning, like, it's very meaningful for me, and somehow that translates, I guess.
Yeah, the model's anatomy is kind of odd to the point of being nearly impossible.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I've always been a fan of Crumb, and I just love the female figure in Big Women, but with that character, it was important for the script that it was important that the artist was obsessed with somebody that no one in the right mind would be obsessed with, I guess, because it made it seem that much more authentic to him, I guess.
Yeah, there have been some people who've definitely compared your art and your sensibility to Robert Crumb and his wife, Aileen Kaminsky Crumb, who are, the giants. We've lost Aileen, of course, but the giants of alternative underground comics. And I'm hearing that your art was actually a big inspiration for their daughter, Sophie Crumb.
Oh, really?
Oh,
Tell me
yeah.
more. I didn't
Well,
know.
supposedly, Sophie has talked about seeing your work, and I can definitely see the same influence in Sophie's jittery line and frantic characters.
Wow, that's cool. Yeah, I'm notoriously out of the loop on this kind of thing, but that's a really cool thing to hear. Yeah, I mean, Crumb is definitely one of my top influences. I have a habit of becoming really obsessed with an artist and then basically just trying to not look at their work from then on, because it's just too tempting to copy them or have too great of an influence. Sometimes it's just indelible. It's just going to stay there, and I just have to interpret it in my own way.
Well, with all the adult-themed books you've drawn, some people might be surprised to hear that you've published children's books and produced kids' TV programs.
I know. It's bizarre. That's another thing that I think I take from Tom Younger is this idea that my work doesn't have to be about one singular facet of my personality. Like, he had some of the most disturbing drawings and then some of the most charming kids' books, and they all felt really genuine, you know? It wasn't like he was pandering in one area and expressing himself genuinely in another. It's just that it all felt like a authentic part of him. And I feel the same way. Like, I love children's books. It's not that I'm trying to subvert things or be clever or nasty. It's just like I can access that part of my personality from when I was a child and just enjoy making work for that age group.
Yeah, I think there's like a real physicality in the best kids' books that, and sometimes almost like a near, like a sense of near horror. Like you look at Beatrix Potter, and yeah, everything's just really sensual and physical, and then there's moments of terror.
Yeah, I think it's all stuff that kids appreciate, and it's a bit sad that things are so homogenous at times in kids' entertainment, books and television. But when things do go a little bit off the beaten path, it seems like it's appreciated. I think it's just the decision makers who are so cautious, you know, in television and publishing. They don't want to rock the boat at all. I'm actually going to be making some children's books for a publisher in France soon for the first time in probably 15 years or something.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I'm super, super excited about it. Like, I get really, really motivated when I think about it. So I'll be starting that in the winter.
Let's see. You originally published, I think it was your first children's book, Bagel's Lucky Hat, and you published it under a pseudonym, Hector Mumbly.
Hector was what my siblings would call me when I was a little kid if I lost my temper. Oh, here comes Hector. Oh, it's Hector. And I would just go completely ballistic. The more they teased me, the more insane I got, you know? But yeah, at the time, I thought it would be a good idea to just keep the two separate in case there was a scenario where, for instance, a mother loves the kid's book and then is like, oh, I'm going to go look at, you know, what other books I can get my kid. And they order Ripple, you know? So yeah, I'm struggling with whether or not to do that with the future books because I'm not sure it's really such an issue. When I made the kids' TV shows, the studios preferred for me to just keep my regular name. So maybe it's not as big an issue as I think.
Yeah, I think originally it was actually Nickelodeon Magazine that asked you to work on some comics stories. And speaking of underground cartoonists who might be considered unlikely kids authors, one of your collaborators at Nick Magazine was Johnny Ryan.
Right. So I was, after I made Weasel, I got into this headspace where I thought I didn't want to write anymore because I was so pleased with how Ripple went. I felt like I couldn't sort of come up with anything as well done. So anytime I would be offered jobs in comics, I would try to find a collaborator to write with me. And Johnny became like the top guy that I would work with. So when Nickelodeon asked me to do short stories, I'd get them to hire Johnny. And then at some point, the development executive at Nickelodeon Animation, who was a fan of my toys and comics, asked me if I would start pitching ideas for a show. And I got Johnny attached for that. So that's how we became collaborators on the Pig Goat Banana Cricket TV show.
Pig, Goat, Banana, Cricket, the unlikely team of characters.
It was originally Pig Goat Banana Robot, and then it was Pig Goat Banana Mantis, but those are all my favorite animals and fruit.
So, yeah, and I guess this was around what, 2008?
Sounds about right. Yeah, it basically came out of the recession. I just days, maybe like a week before the recession, I think I had my biggest opening in Los Angeles. I made my biggest work, and we priced very high, and I was super excited. And then the recession hit, and it was just like basically my career ended for a few years. You know, I was making no money at all. And in the past, I had always received offers to work in television and film, and I basically was like, "Oh, I'm a fine artist. I'm not going to do that." So after the recession, I was like, "Okay, that's it. I'm going to just say yes to everything." Nickelodeon called, and a producer interested in adapting my kid's book to television called, and there was an opportunity with the Norwegian Film Institute to make a short film, and I just took it all and really, really focused and applied myself and decided like this is going to be my new medium. I'm just going to make the best animation I can think of. It's just so strange that they all came to fruition because when I had two TV shows in development, I never would have dreamed that both would be picked up, but they were both picked up around the same time. So it was a bizarre time in my life. Felt very lucky.
I've heard old-time animators complain about shows like King of the Hill, where the world is just a suburban world with ranch-style houses, and they say, what's the fun of that? In animation, you can bring anything to life. You can make trees dance like in the old Fleischer Brothers cartoons.
I get the sentiment, but I think for those kinds of shows, it would just be so out of place. I think the fact that they're so plain and visually homogenous is why people are able to sort of settle and just, like get to know the characters and hear the jokes. But yeah, that would not be a good application of my skills. I love like I've done some visual development in big Hollywood movies too, and I just find that again so thrilling because they really want you to push it and come up with worlds and characters and vehicles that no one's ever seen before. So that's really fun.
So, Dave, you're currently touring with the early episodes of Doghead. You're in the Pacific Northwest. Any plans for future touring?
Well, I have that European thing in the winter. We're going to do Madrid, Angoulême, Paris, and Amsterdam. There's a comic shop in Amsterdam that has an apartment above the store that we can use for as long as we want. So we're pretty thrilled about that. Anytime I have a tour or business trip of any kind, we, Maria and I, try to turn it into like some kind of little romantic adventure as well. So that's like one of the highlights for us. Next year we might do the states, like the southern states, like a road trip book tour.
Nice. See how many of your books you can get banned.
Yeah, exactly. Oh God, the news was pretty devastating.
Yeah, I am of the belief that, well, art is a political act, so just keep doing art and and other stuff too. But yes. Any other projects on the horizon?
The kids' book, just painting. I'm painting towards another show in Paris in a couple of years. Doghead will be coming out on a regular basis, so that's something to watch for. Oh, and my Patreon, it's an ongoing project that I do. It's patreon.com/doghead, where I do like videos of the process and time lapse videos, and I discuss my drawing and painting and things like that.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, SW Conser. And we've been talking today with comics artist, animator, and oil painter, Dave Cooper. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much, Coach.
And for those listeners who might be interested in finding out more about your work, where would they look?
My Instagram's good. It's at DaveCooper67. And Patreon would be a good place too. Patreon.com/doghead.
Well, thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of the show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.